Okay, we're back. 86 Generative Energy with Georgi Dinkov. Georgi, how are you, sir?
I'm all right. Thanks for asking. Still afloat.
We were just talking about the really fun subject of the death of Gary Webb and Danny Casalena and the Clinton associate. So that's how we kicked off tonight.
And Ivana Trump, who ruled to have died from multiple blunt force traumas to the body, to the torso, not the head. Like, okay, I mean, this is really pushing into La La Land. Like, I don't know, they're just laughing in our faces with those kind of statements. I mean, okay, she was, 73? So she's not that old, okay? And she wasn't decrepit. She was actually in pretty good health. So for a person like that to die from, like, let's say, if the coroner found that she had hit her head, right, on the corner of a coffee table or something and caused some kind of internal bleeding in the brain, yeah, that's believable. It's rare, but it happens, right? But to die from not one, multiple blunt force traumas to the torso, not the head, and still be ruled accidental. What did she do? Like, grab the hammer and beat herself with it to death? Like, I just don't get it. How can these things be ruled accidental? And at least the CNN article just announced that quietly. And if CNN actually does this, like announces something very quickly, like matter-of-factly, and moves on, you can usually guarantee there's more, you know, to the story. So we'll see what happens. But maybe it'll happen just like that. What was the guy, Gary Sherman, in Canada, where they found him and his wife hanged, and then initially it was ruled suicide, but then it turned out it's a very professionally done hit. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, eventually something like that turns out to happen to Ivana. Maybe she was, you know, too close to Trump or, you know, I don't know. We'll see. But I don't think multiple blunt force traumas to the torso can be easily ruled accidental. You don't, you know, okay, if you fall down some stairs, right, unless you break your neck, you're not going to die from, like, the bruises that falling down some stairs will do. Like, in order for these hits, these blows to your body to kill you, they must be pretty severe. Like, somebody must have been pummeling her really hard with fists or some other hard objects to cause, basically, internal bleeding, you know, organ damage, especially liver, spleen, right? You know, break ribs that can then, like, damage some of the internal organs. So this is no joke, you know, and from what I can understand from the article, she wasn't ruled to have fallen from stairs, and she wasn't ruled to have jumped from a window. So it's really, it's a very bizarre story, bordering almost on the bizarreness of the Epstein murder. I'm sorry, what did I say, murder? She's suicide in a cell where basically, like, the ceiling is, what, 12 feet high? And there's almost no place where he can tie anything, and his sheets are made from paper. So this guy has nothing basically to hang himself with, and then they find him with a broken neck in a way that can only be done through asphyxiation.
Makes sense to Anyways. Me. There is I used to be really into documentaries, especially like true crime documentaries, and there was one called The Staircase, which was kind of like what you described, the Trump murder or potential murder, but anyway, so we're getting off to a dark start.
Dark? I mean, it's just one person dead. Like, the World War III is knocking on our door. I think that's the real darkness.
I know. What? We'll talk about that. Is there any new development that you've learned since the last time we talked?
I mean, like, worldwide or here in D.C.?
Either.
The crime continues to rise in D.C. The shootings are ongoing and continue to rise. D.C. is basically set to break the record for violent murders over the last, basically, I think it's on course to surpass the second. I mean, the next highest, deadliest year in terms of violent crime, I think, was like 2005 or 2006. Mm-hmm. So what, 17 years? Mm-hmm. So it's a 17-year record. What else? I've noticed that Whole Foods is now routinely out of a number of products that seem to be made in Germany, mm-hmm. specifically the Gerolsteiner water. Mm-hmm. It's out in most of the Whole Foods, actually all of the Whole Foods stores in DC proper. I used to order it through Amazon, but basically now they're out. And I went to several stores just to make sure that Amazon is not lying or like refusing to sell it online. And they're completely out. So I'm tying that to the articles that are coming up on various non-Western websites saying that the German economy is collapsing. And basically, like, their industry is drastically, decreasing its production, both for domestic and in international markets. So we'll see what happens with that. Other than that, I mean, it's pretty much the same. It's just a lot of nervous people, like a lot of car accidents in DC. This kind of like I thought the peak was last year, like in the summer of 2021, because then in the fall things started to like kind of calm down. Now we're back up and actually surpassing 2021 summer in terms of road rage accidents and people basically like I don't know, like without even hitting each other, somebody cuts somebody off, then the person who was cut off gets out of the car, starts randomly shooting, not even at the person who cut him or her off, like just randomly shooting at buildings and at other people. So that seems to be like those kind of incidents seem to be increasing. Other than that, I guess it's still the same.
I had purchased like 100 bags of oat bran on iHerb.com, and then I went back to purchase more, and it had gone up almost half double the price. So it was like $3 when I purchased them, and it was, guys, I'm kind of sick by the way, but it was almost $6 when I had gone back, and so. I don't make that much money. That's pretty shocking to me of doubling something like a staple item. That sucks.
So you realize what kind of boatload of crap the official numbers of 9.1%, which is shocking, shocking. The inflation is, this is absurd. I don't even know of, show me one item. One consumer item that has whose prices has basically risen 9% or less, right? Mm-hmm. So if this is the average, you must have items that are more, and then you must have items that are less, right? Or items somewhere in between. Show me those items. I don't know of anything that basically has had a price increase of less than 20%. And how can we have an inflation that is just still a single digit number? This is, to me, this is insane. And again, it's like basically shows you that. And then they're saying like, oh, the Fed may be forced to do something incredibly drastic about this. Raise the interest rate by 1%. That's the drastic action. Drastic action would be to raise the interest rate by almost as much as inflation is, which is 20%, right? Even that's not, because inflation is higher than that over the last 2 years. Like there was the guy Volcker in the 80s who like raised the interest rates to 20%. Mm-hmm. That would be drastic. So if the market is scared of a 1% increase of interest rates, it shows you what a complete joke and travesty of an economy the Western world has. It's all basically recycling fake money, which the central banks print. And then basically when this is over, like when this kind of cycle does one full cycle, everybody makes their cut, right? Then they need more money to spin it yet again. But there's no productive activity behind it. So I don't know. I think hyperinflation is for all intents and purposes here. I don't think they'll be able to rein it in with these miserable, pathetic risings of the interest rate of like, even if they raise it to 5%, it's still nothing, right? But it will cause a recession. So I guess the Fed was right on time. What was the quote you posted on Telegram, that the servers are ready to go? CBDC is ready to kick off in like February 2023, right on time.
Do you want to share the last thing you said to Ray on the last podcast about is it ready to leave the cities?
Yeah. I mean, I asked him like, okay, so do you think basically like that's it, you know, the West is basically done. And I think, I mean, he's never, I guess he doesn't want to panic people, but he's one of the few times where he basically, his pause was not as long as I thought it would be. He kind of paused for 1 or 2 seconds, like, yeah. And it's like, it's kind of time to leave. Start thinking about leaving. I asked him, like, you think it's time to start thinking leaving the city? He said, yeah.
That was the one thing go ahead, sorry.
No. I said, and then we talked about basically like, well, what happens if the nukes start flying? He says, drive as fast as you can down south, because the radioactive wind basically will be the worst in the northern hemisphere. The further north you are, the worse it will be.
Yeah. Remember, maybe it was like 2 or 3 episodes ago, we asked him, do you think things will get chaotic citizenry wise? And I think he kind of said he didn't think so.
Said that in the cities that he thought they will have enough law enforcement resources to kind of like keep things under control.
That seems crazy.
I don't think that's true. I'm seeing here, well, of course, a lot of it is on purpose. The police has been told in D.C. not to bother the people that are running around and carjacking and robbing and shooting and et cetera, et cetera. Just contributes to the chaos, which they all want, right? The elite wants that. But not a chaos to the point of basically marauding gangs start running around and basically kill everything in their path, rape, pillage, plunder, etc. There was a interview with, I think, the second guy in command for the D.C. police, for MPD, Metro Police Department. Mm. And he basically said, look, if tomorrow we have a large-scale riot that involves more than 200 people willing to actually riot and kill and shoot, he's like, I don't think we can handle them. It's like the police force will basically walk out. They're tired of being abused. They're tired of being told, like, you can't arrest this or can't arrest that, can't do this. And then they, when they do arrest somebody who's, if they get to the point of arresting somebody, that means it's a really egregious case. Yeah. And even those cases, the district attorney has said that unless it's a murder one, he's saying, I'm not going to prosecute it. I'm going to send him right back to basically the social improvement / justice system. They call them the violence interrupters. Look, if there is a 30-year-old thug in front of you who's done nothing but crime his whole life, and he kills on a whim, I don't think sending him to the violence interrupters will do much good, except that he may actually end up killing those violence interrupters, and it may finally, you know, spur some movement, some reaction, some real change. But yeah, so we got a situation here which is not dissimilar to what is happening in San Francisco and L.A. I think over there, anything under $1,000 of theft is not even recorded. It's recorded, but it's not prosecuted. It's not even like labeled as a crime. Nobody bothers with it. So here, basically, like you know, the district attorney has come on record officially and has said, "I will not prosecute actively unless I really." He kind of said, "Unless I'm really bored and I have nothing else to do," which is not the case. I will not prosecute anything less than more than one, even like a second degree murder. He's saying, look, for these people, there's still a chance we can reform them. A lot of them, you know, for a lot of them, the reason they committed this crime, it's like racial oppression, racism. So let's deal with them with the money. The city keeps pouring resources into these social justice programs and violence interrupters. That's what they call them, actually. The study just came out, commissioned by the city, which tells you just this, already the study will be extremely biased in favor of the city, right, of the program. But even that study said the violence interrupters are useless. They haven't prevented a single violent crime. Why? Because they actually avoid dealing with the real bad puppies, because those real bad puppies will show up to the meeting with a few guns, right? And the moment you cross them, they'll start firing. You know, they don't care about your stupid, I don't know, whatever you're going to try to do, wow them with. I don't know, religion, family, faith, something like society, community, right? I don't give a rat's butt about that.
You can curse on this show, Georgie. Don't worry about it.
Let's keep it civilized. Yeah, okay. More civilized than the world already is.
I just spent a metric ass load of money on security stuff. So cameras, and then there's something called the night lock. And so it's basically like a door barricade. You put it on the door. So even if somebody broke through your lock, they couldn't push the door open. Right. And so, again, because I'm really worried. I don't have like cell phone coverage here. So if something really happened, it would be all completely up to me to do something about it. And so I think the first line of defense is making the house seem like you don't want to go rob it, like having security cameras everywhere. And the new ones are really good. They have deterrent functions. And so you could set up like some perimeter, like saying if somebody walks in this area, you can do an alarm. And it's like pretty good, like the new types of power over Ethernet types of security cameras and things. But
if you were me, I'll probably do the exact opposite. I'll make it look like a slum. So basically nobody thinks that it's going to be worth their time, a slum. And then also like a sinister looking slum that they know that if they try to get in, they'll probably get injured or something else will happen. Something bad. I don't know.
Two different.
If you can
ways
find a few fake human skeletons and kind of like sprinkle some bones around and like some fake skulls, like realistically looking, right? Sprinkle them around the property. And when people ask you, like, what the hell are those? And you just quietly look deep into their eyes and say, trespassers.
The dark episode.
Why? It was meant tongue-in-cheek, but actually some people have done that successfully in, like, African countries to, like, prevent marauding. And actually, I do mean a specific example. Some farmers in Zimbabwe and in South Africa basically have resorted to these methods to basically discourage gangs from trying to like rob the farm and kill the families that are running it.
I'll go have to dig up a skeleton and then I can start that line of my home defense.
Don't you have enough of those in the closet, Dan? Is that the expression?
my closet is skeleton free. Thank goodness. But okay.
We all do, but yeah. I think at this point, like considering the situation, we've probably all made peace with our skeletons.
Okay, so what? The last episode of the Ray, I thought it was pretty good. The protein stuff was interesting. The audience needs to know that if you listen to that, I kind of presupposed that Ray had changed his mind on the protein stuff, and I don't think Ray saw it that way. And so I sent an email to Ray and I was like, hey, I apologize. I didn't mean to like make that whole interview awkward for you, because I think he thinks, and again, I'm kind of speculating here, I think he thinks that the low protein stuff is a continuation of thoughts he has already had about cysteine, methionine, and tryptophan. And so I don't think eating 50 grams or something is bizarre to him. It was odd to me because I had never heard him say that low before. And I'm not saying this because I think everybody has to eat 50 grams. It was a contextualized discussion, and he said ad nauseum that he was doing it at for advanced age. So, anyways,
if you look at some of my posts in the forum from like circa 2014, 15, you'll see several posts about that essential amino acid MAP. There's a product that basically like, and I have a post that amino acid supplementation for people with bad digestion, and they do say that, and I think you probably agree with that. Basically, they're creating this mix of essential amino acids, and they're, if you look at their product, it's kind of low on tryptophan and methionine, right? Both of these are essential amino acids, and they're saying like basically like if you take that as your protein, you can get by on, I don't know, like one half to one third of your daily intake, normal daily intake, which if you normally eat 100 grams of protein a day, you know, let's say on average, that means with those amino acids, basically you can get by on 50 to 30 grams of protein a day, which would qualify as a low protein diet. And I think Ray's version, when he says low protein, I think he's saying low protein because he wants to avoid those specific amino acids. If you can eat, like, let's say most of your protein to be gelatin and then the rest supplemented with the essential amino acids while keeping the tryptophan, cysteine, and methionine as low as possible, you can eat a lot more protein. You can eat 100 grams of gelatin and then another like 30 grams of the essential amino acids. And I don't think Ray will have a problem with that because none of those activate the mTOR pathway much.
Yeah, again, we never clarified if that's what he was getting at. It didn't sound like that, though. It sounded like he was restricting all protein. It did not. I could be completely wrong. Did you get a sense that he was taking?
Well, that's why I asked him that question. I said, like, basically, like, you know, in some of those studies, you know, basically where they are doing the caloric restriction, right? And he said, well, you don't have to restrict the calories as long as you restrict the protein, the amino acids that are activating that pathway. Basically, you can achieve the same effects. Not all of the amino acids activate that pathway. Some of the essential ones do. I think the branch chain amino acids are heavy activators of the mTOR. I think tryptophan, methionine, and cysteine he dislikes simply because of their anti-metabolic effects, with tryptophan being unique among all of them that it's actually carcinogenic in and of itself. So if you can eat, I don't think you'll have a problem with you eating as much gelatin as you want, as long as you have like the minimum amount of necessary essential amino acids. So I would actually ask him that specific question next time we meet. I'll say, okay, if somebody would eat, let's say the low protein diet, let's say 50 grams of protein daily, right, of complete protein, would it be a problem if they eat like basically an additional 100 grams of gelatin a day? Would that actually, you know, put them into the high protein problematic area, which you seem to be trying to avoid? My bet is he'll say no. They can eat all the gelatin they want, provided it's balanced by a sufficient amount of carbohydrates.
That would be the thing, because the protein, even if it was gelatin, would still be insulinogenic, and that could still
not really. No. With the glycine and proline, they actually have an anti-insulin effect. There is a human study showing that 6 grams of glycine basically dropped the post-prandial, which is after meal, blood glucose response by 50%. Mm-hmm. Like it blunted it by half. So glycine and some of the other proline and hydroxyproline and maybe even beta-alanine, some of those amino acids seem to be basically capable of filling in for insulin and kind of helping to dispose of and metabolize the glucose so that you don't need to release as much insulin as normally you do.
Let me rephrase. When I've used the powders, the powder gelatin, I've experienced wicked hypoglycemia if I use those without enough carbohydrate.
I don't think that's from the insulin response though. Glycine can actually lower the blood glucose, and that's why one of the reasons why older studies use it for diabetes. But it's not the same mechanism as if you're injecting more insulin. I'll show you. The human study showed lower insulin and lower glucose response after a meal, which doesn't make any sense because you would expect basically, okay, if that 6 grams of glycine lower the glucose by increasing insulin, you would have expected to see the high insulin in the blood. It not only didn't rise, it actually declined parallel to the glucose. So something in those amino acids helps the body utilize the glucose with less insulin. It could be somehow blunting the effects of cortisol, which rises after you eat, probably during probably because of the rising endotoxin, which happens after almost every meal, especially in people over 30, mm-hmm. with compromised gut barrier, etc. So could be that, right? It could be so because insulin and cortisol they kind of go hand in hand. If you lower cortisol, you'll usually lower insulin as well. That drug RU486, the abortion pill, which was actually developed as a cortisol blocker, it still is cortisol blocker. But when they gave they use it off label for treating diabetes type 2. And it shows you basically that when you take that drug and it blocks the effects of cortisol, insulin levels decline. So the high insulin after a meal is probably, I mean, it could be just the amino acids. The essential amino acids do have an insulinogenic effect, right? But basically the high effect, the rise of insulin after a meal could also be just that, you know, like because of the elevated cortisol. And if you find a way to block the effects of cortisol, lower that rising cortisol, maybe insulin doesn't need to rise as much. I don't know. Very interesting study, but human study, and not that high of a dose of glycine. If gelatin is about 20 to 30% glycine, 5 grams of glycine, it means about 30 grams of gelatin would give you that amount. So really not that much and a really dramatic improvement in insulin sensitivity.
Fair enough. Okay. Okay, let's move on here. You have a lot of really interesting articles. Was there one that you were very excited to chat about?
No. Just speak whatever you want. I mean, like,
there were some good ones. Let me read through here. What about?
Well, maybe the exercise? The one from today?
Yeah, that's good. Let's start with that one.
So, I mean, we've been talking about this for a very long time. Ray has been writing about this for a very long time, kind of saying, look, there's a difference between naturally slim without people who basically seem to be staying slim, you know, they eat pretty much whatever they want, and people who stay slim through effort, right? The latter is not healthy, and multiple studies have shown it. Of course, there's multiple fake studies being thrown out there, most of them association studies saying, oh, yes, if you run 10 miles every day, you're going to live forever, et cetera, et cetera. Biochemically, none of that can be true. And basically, like, it's always been basically medicine has made the kind of like begged the question by saying, high BMI is bad, so anything that lowers BMI must be good, right? And then even have these shows, The Biggest Loser. If you remember the study, they're basically like when they made these people lose a lot of weight in a truly stressful manner through a combination of drastic caloric restriction and exercise, and then basically like after the show ended, first of all, most of the people did not lose enough weight with those methods, so they ended up drugging them behind the scenes, basically, secretly, which many people told people that story afterwards, even though they signed a non-disclosure agreement, exposing themselves to lawsuit risk. But anyways, many of those people actually given weight loss drugs, and that's how they lost the weight. But a lot of it, there was, you know, they still couldn't avoid the regimen of brutal exercise and starvation. And every single one of those people that participated in that show that lost weight not only gained it within 6 months of stopping that regimen, but actually shot above that weight by up to 30%. So whatever that thing is, so basically, yes, you can say that with sufficient willpower and sufficient torturing of yourself, anybody can lose the weight. But can you keep it off? And first of all, why is it coming back? Well, it turns out to be a pretty simple answer. Basically, when you're stressing yourself, yeah, the catabolic hormones rise, adrenaline and cortisol, you're going to lose muscle, you're going to lose fat. Actually, first you're going to lose your muscle before you start losing a lot of fat. But let's say you persist and eventually you get to this catabolic state where you basically lose most of your muscle and your fat. And then when you stop, cortisol, actually your baseline cortisol will now be elevated. Remember, I think we discussed that study where the expression of the cortisol synthesizing enzyme 11-beta-HSD1 is actually 2 to 3 times higher in people that participate in long-term endurance exercise, especially running. Or even, cycling is a little bit better, but running, even boxing, boxing is, that's subconcentric, but still, something that engages you in quote-unquote aerobic capacity way beyond your glycogen levels. So after you start, basically it comes down to burning fat. After you start burning the fat, and many of the gurus say this is great, that's what you should be striving for, right? After you start doing that, you're already in the diabetes / cancer metabolism. And over time, if you persist in your lunacy, as William Blake said, the madman who persists in his madness becomes wise, I would add, or ends up dead. So you have two choices here. You're either going to hit the wall, develop some nasty disease, as many of us learned the hard way, and then you eventually wisen up and realize that it is actually something endocrinological going on, that, you know, you keep gaining that weight. And this study said that people who are naturally slim, they actually are up to 30% less active than the other people who are exercising or overweight, et cetera, et cetera. And perhaps most importantly, their thyroid, the levels of the thyroid hormone T3 specifically, is basically much higher. And that basically you have people who live a quite sedentary lifestyle. They do eat a little bit less, but only about 10% less, than the other groups. But the one distinguishing characteristic, actually the two distinguishing characteristics, is actually they're not stressing themselves, right? Actually the physical activity is up to a 25% lower than everybody else, while simultaneously having up to 50% higher levels of T3. And that's what, according to the study, explained the difference between the weight of these people and everybody else. Most importantly, so when you have these discussions with people who are, you know, exercise fanatics, they'll tell you, after you throw sufficient evidence at them, at some point, some of them will be like, okay, I admit it. Yes, if you lose weight through stress, eventually, basically, you'll come back unless you keep stressing yourself. I get it. I don't think it's a good thing. But we're actually not exercising so much for the weight loss benefits. We're exercising because it improves a lot of the cardiovascular health biomarkers, cholesterol, triglycerides, C-reactive protein, all of these things. And it turns out that actually those biomarkers in the sedentary hyperthyroid people, they're not really hyperthyroid, but they probably qualified compared to the people who are over-exercising themselves. Compared to those people, the cardiovascular biomarkers of those people were stellar, the ones that actually were sedentary and with high thyroid. So again, the argument for exercise based on this study falls apart completely. There's nothing exercise can offer except temporarily make you maybe slimmer, but in a bad way, because you're going to lose more muscle than you lose fat, right? While in the long run, potentially not only making you just as fat, if not more than before, if you stop it, but also worsening your cardiovascular biomarkers. I posted a study maybe 2 weeks ago, which could be in the list there on the first page, showing that basically endurance exercise ages a male's cardiovascular system by more than a decade. And when you look at that, it basically kind of hints towards cortisol being the issue, that basically the arteries of people, of elite athletes participating in endurance exercise, let's say marathon runners, current culture thinks of them as the epitome of health. These people are skinny, basically have no fat and also no muscle. If you look at them, they look like a stick, right? They're skinny, they can run like 26 miles. What's not to like? Well, it turns out that they're biochemically, these people are 10 to 15 years older. And many of them either quit because they sense like they can't do it anymore, or suffer a cardiovascular event during during one of those events where they're running.
A lot of people that exercise a lot seem to have really bad mood and personality problems as well. Something that I've noticed talking to lots of people.
I think it's from the serotonin. Every time you run and basically like you jerk or you twist your gastrointestinal tract, mm-hmm. The intestine starts to synthesize and release a lot of serotonin. Mm-hmm. 90% of serotonin is produced there. So anything that physically, mechanically stresses that area of your body, it's going to generate a lot of serotonin. Now, if you like bruise your hand or you rub it or you do like a blunt force trauma, the redness over there, those cells can also produce serotonin and histamine, hence the redness, but not nearly as much as what the intestine can do. And you don't have to hit yourself in the stomach to cause that. Just simply running for like more than half an hour is probably enough to cause it, which is corroborated by the fact that if you look at the marathon, there's like they have these pictures of like basically marathon runners crapping themselves like while running the marathon. It's not a coincidence. It's basically drastic overproduction of serotonin, which happens in most of these people. That's what's leading them to have diarrhea while running.
This is another Blake quote, and he says, "Those that put their bodies to endure are fools." I'm gonna be really clear here. Like, if you enjoy weightlifting,
he's contradicting himself. The fool who persists in his foolishness becomes wise.
I want to be really clear here. If you enjoy exercising and it brings some like meaning to your life or something, we're not saying don't do it, or people that exercise are all like weightlift are unhealthy or something. We're saying, I think it's more contextually, when a low thyroid person is exercising, yeah, it's usually leading to poorer health.
And also, as I say in my blog post, like the mantra is like the detrimental mantra, which I'm actually speaking out against, is the no pain, no gain. In other words, if you're not suffering, it's not worth it. If you're not suffering, you're not going to reap any benefits. That part is pathological. That should go away. But if you're riding your bike for 20, 30 minutes, if you're feeling great, if it's stimulating, if it's interesting, if it's fun, right? I mean, that's the simplest way to put it. If it's fun and non-routine, it is probably doing more good than bad. If you start feeling like you're pushing yourself to do it, if you had a long day at work and then you have to go on like on an hour bike ride and you're like, oh, I don't feel like that, I just want to collapse in front of the TV. It's probably better if you collapse in front of the TV instead of going for the bike ride. You're going to be doing less damage.
Yeah. I've talked to actually multiple people that needed to exercise so they could go to bed, which is really bad. Like, you need to go to exhaustion so you can even go to sleep. But here's an old 1947 reference. From Merck Manual, and they say exercise should be constricted until improvement is well advanced in the case of hypothyroidism.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to die on this podcast, but my throat is so sore. So let's get to another article before I die. Okay. Well, what you just said kind of leads right into reductive stress. And so do you want to tie – what is aren't there two articles here about reductive stress?
One of them is about cancer, and there was another one. Let me see.
Maybe we could jump into the cancer one, because you said, hey, you can if the stress gets bad enough and the thyroid gets suppressed, you can like immediately shift into the diabetes or the cancer metabolism. And so a lot of times somebody will say, I think I got diabetes. And so why is that kind of thinking not really correct? Like, if somebody can slip in and out of this state pretty quickly.
Of the reductive stress? Actually, the people with chronic diseases are characterized by the so-called metabolic inflexibility. Mm-hmm. Children are known to be able to switch from oxidizing glucose to fat pretty seamlessly without any problem. Like if a child, let's say a 12-year-old child, plays a soccer game for 90 minutes, at some point they'll be burning mostly fat, right, while running around. But then as soon as the soccer game stops, then they drink their Gatorade or whatever other crap their mom gives them with sugar, right? Then the stress hormones go down and then they go back to oxidizing glucose. That seems not to be the case with older and or sicker people. And now we know, we've already discussed that aging and disease are the same thing. Not even two sides of the same coin. They're actually the same thing. Just one of them is a more accelerated version of the other. And this study shows that basically due to the reductive stress, because the cancer cell cannot really now use glucose as efficiently and also cannot use the electron transport chain efficiently for anabolic purposes, to synthesize more DNA and RNA for its own proliferation purposes, the cancer cells are forced to actually start importing fats from the environment, from the blood, in order to continue to survive. And it's basically the reductive, but because of the Randall cycle, as it's actually even the Wikipedia page says, burning fat, so because it forms a vicious circle. Burning fat actually further lowers the NAD to the NADH ratio, which puts the cancer cell into even further away into reductive stress, which means more fats need to be imported, and so on. It goes until basically the fat, the cell, the cancer cell, quote unquote, is essentially just like the diabetic cell. It basically burns nothing but fat, and any glucose that even makes it to the cell just goes through glycolysis, and the vast majority of it is converted to lactate. It shows that cancer, both as a disease of extreme reductive stress and also reductive stress, and cancer also contributing further to that reductive stress. So it's kind of a vicious circle, and several diseases seem to be like that. Once you form the vortex, the pathological vortex of your health, it seems hard to break through to break out of it, because these two, the two ends of it, kind of like feed into each other. So you have to be able to somehow break out of it. And one way seems to be to get rid of this reductive stress, which is by either increasing the NAD or decreasing the NADH, right? Several ways to do that. You can reoxidize NADH back to NAD with a quinone. You can raise NAD levels by supplying a precursor such as niacinamide. You can take thyroid hormone, which forces, basically accelerates the whole chain reaction from Krebs cycle through the electron transport chain. So NADH is naturally oxidized back to NAD through those steps, while the quinones directly actually oxidize the NADH without having to go through that through those steps. And the article hinted, saying that basically as soon as the cancer cell breaks out of the reductive stress, it commits apoptosis. So that's the way to, quote unquote, kill the cancer cell. Cancer cell is so unhealthy, since it's already acquired mutations, it knows it's deranged, and actually it will kill itself if you give it a chance. The way to do that is by dropping the intracellular pH ratio, which depends on carbon dioxide production, which depends on the redox ratio, NAD to the NADH. If you do that, if you acidify the cell naturally through the production of carbon dioxide, if the cell is abnormal, it will tag itself for destruction. You don't need to take chemotherapy, which kills indiscriminately and gives you a secondary cancer, or take any of the other measures that modern medicine has conveniently provided for you to happily commit suicide with.
Or shrinks your brain. Do we talk about that? How it like shrinks the
chemotherapy?
Matter or something considerably.
Anyways. And one study showed that one of the primary mechanisms through which it does that is by drastically lowering your synthesis of DHEA. But I'm thinking they only measure DHEA. If they've measured pregnenolone and progesterone, they would have probably found that those are low too, because I don't think chemotherapy selectively somehow inhibits the enzyme that synthesizes DHEA. If it inhibits something that high up in the chain, chances are it's inhibiting the other precursors, the other two precursors, right? And probably increasing cholesterol.
It reminded me of when Ray said we were talking about DHT or something, and he was saying like, yeah, for a big problem, you want as many things to push in the opposite direction as possible.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was like a useful way to look at it. Like there are so many things, like we live in a reducing, it's hard being an oxidized person in a reducing environment. And so that's why we need so many of these things to push towards oxidation and away from reduction, because the stresses are so prevalent that it's so easy just to rapidly age in the environment we currently inhabit.
I think that the two most important things one can do for neurodegenerative disease is take something that takes care of the unpaired electrons, right? Something like, as a long-term strategy, something like aspirin and methylene blue, or like vitamin K and methylene blue. Vitamin K and aspirin. Vitamin K and aspirin is probably like hands down, a universal to me, prophylactic, because vitamin K will take care of the excess electrons, and aspirin will not only take care of the inflammation, chronic inflammation, which we all have and drives all kinds of degenerative diseases, but the aspirin itself is prometabolic. It stimulates all of the aspects of the metabolic chain. Yes, it does stimulate glycolysis, but it also stimulates the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain. And in high doses, it's also an uncoupler. So it will raise your core body temperature too, which is very, very important for all things, from immunity to cancer to basically diabetes to cognitive function. If you remember, like maybe last year was when we discussed, I had a study about raising body temperature as a way to actually cure up to 40% of the cancers. There are several studies which Ray knew very well about those. Basically, if you heat the tumor to about 41 degrees centigrade, it will induce an almost immediate and spontaneous cure, not remission. The tumor will disappear in a matter of days and not come back in about 40% of the cases. And in another, maybe about 30 to 40, it will shrink to the point where basically it's no longer a threat, right? You can then manage it much more much more easily with things like aspirin, progesterone, and whatnot. And over time, that will probably disappear as well. Just the study did not last that long. So aspirin and vitamin K or aspirin and methylene blue, probably, you know, a universal prophylactic that addresses the two main aspects of bad health, such as inflammation and chronic reductive stress, which every doctor will tell you, oh, it's oxidative stress. It's it's not oxidative stress. All of these reactive oxygen species are actually reductants. They're reduced forms of oxygen or its byproducts. It's not the molecular oxygen that actually withdraw electrons. Like all of the reactive oxygen species, what a poor name. I mean, really, like it's basically led entire fields of medicine astray by convincing people that this is from too much oxygen, which is the exact opposite. It's from like not consuming enough oxygen, or at least not using it properly. So aspirin and vitamin K or aspirin, methylene blue, and you know, in some cases, even those, if you really have like a legitimately low thyroid function, you just don't produce enough T3, I just don't think there's a way around this. At some point, you may have to supplement with T3. I think Broder Barnes agrees. He's basically said that once you reach a certain level of thyroid failure or like suboptimal activity, you kind of need that thyroid because you just can't really get back on your feet the way you were before unless you supplement with thyroid.
And that was in the 70s when he was treating people. So they were, oh my God, I'm gonna die. And then, so the environment was so much better back then than it was now. I don't even think I could do this podcast without aspirin. So I'm very grateful to it for allowing me to have basic functioning while I'm talking to you, Georgie.
You should have vaccinated Danny. You thought it by running away to Mexico and not meeting with people, you're not going to get infected?
I think I know why I'm a little under the weather, but I'll spare everybody and not explain it. So
I think they can guess.
Yeah. So, okay. Maybe we'll talk about Idea Labs now because we've been talking for 45 minutes already. Okay. Let's go to idealabsdc.com. And I could give you a shout out. I've been using a lot of your quinone product. So the price has not gone up. That's amazing. Thanks for that. The Thorin product is like $70. I ordered five of these and you put them in olive oil for me. And I was using it orally for a while, but then I switched to just using it back to topically. And the one huge thing.
People have told me that they kind of like the olive oil version also topically. I thought I strictly released it for people who wanted to use it orally. But it seems that some people say, you know what, I actually like it topically even better than the ethanol one.
Yeah, you know what you did really well in it is the Thorin one is very slippery. So the MCT oil is very slick. And so when I use that on my legs, I could use an eighth of a teaspoon, which is about 25 milligrams. And so if 10% is absorbed, I'll get like 2.5 milligrams and my leg will be like an oil slick. But your product is way more viscous. And so you can actually put way more on your skin than you could with the Thorin product, which is more expensive and an MCT oil. So I think you hit a home run there. I will be purchasing more shortly here. I just purchased a grip of aspirin just for the future, you know. And thanks for that. And I purchased it at full price, by the way. No special deals here, nor did I want one. So thank you, Georgie, for doing
that. Yes. No mercy for you, Dan.
Yeah, no mercy on my bank.
No mercy for anybody, including me.
But what else is going on?
With Idea Labs, I mean, did we mention released a steroid testing service in nail and hair? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some pretty interesting results are basically coming up. We, managed to diagnose a few diseases that people didn't know. But now we're actually finding out that we may be able to detect other things. Well, we kind of suspect
you,
it
you
is
wanna,
because
you want to be real careful with your language there, right, George?
About what?
Diagnosing the disease.
Oh, no. Oh, okay. Well, our results spurred people. Actually, I mean, it's thank you for correcting, because we ourselves didn't diagnose, but based on the information, people got suspicious about having something. Okay. Went back to the doctor, and when the doctor started digging further, it was confirmed through blood results that what we found was there. I mean, not that we found, but what our results were corroborated by the doctor when the doctor did some more specific blood tests, which is kind of the goal of this, right? I mean, basically, first it serves a kind of like a longer-term assessment of your steroid balance. And then if this thing shows some abnormality, then you may, of course, you always want to go back to your doctor and say, hey, what do you think of those results? I mean, I don't make any secret of it. I'm not saying this just as a disclaimer, because precisely because this is not like a one-off thing. It's what happened. It measures things over the course of more than a month, right? So it's good as like a long-term indicator of where things are going, or at least have been, right? But it doesn't tell you how you are right now. So if something is off there, there's no replacement for the blood tests, then you go to your doctor and say, hey, this is what seems to have been happening 3 months ago for a period of 3 to 5 months ago, right? For over a period of 2 months. Like, what do you think? And then the doctor decides if he or she thinks things are normal, if a follow-up is needed, etc. So by all means, talk to your doctor about this. So far, actually, knock on wood, every single doctor that has seen those results has been extremely positive about them. You know, they say, oh, wow, we've always wanted something like this to complement the blood tests. And in fact, several doctors said, you know what? Unless you come into my office and you're about to fall apart and croak, I'm not going to actually do the blood test, because I know very well those are unreliable. Many people have the white coat syndrome. You're afraid of me, or you're afraid of the environment, right? Of course, I shouldn't be testing your cortisol, because I expect it to be through the roof. This is insane. So they're saying, I want to know how you really are in your natural environment when you're not meeting doctors on a regular basis, right? Which is exactly what the nail and hair testing should be able to do. But now by looking through the literature, it seems like we may be able to detect many other things that are beneficial, specifically related to like metabolic and mood/mental health. We can detect melatonin, histamine, serotonin, dopamine, epinephrine and norepinephrine, which these two things combined kind of give you like a pretty good idea of how you're doing stress-wise, and specifically because, of course, these things affect your system as a whole, but as you well know, most of the mental health drugs are acting on the serotonin or epinephrine/norepinephrine system. So the stress really manifests into the brain through cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, and histamine as well. So if you manage to assess these things, then you get like a pretty good idea of how things are, not only like systemically, but you know, if somebody comes with a, you know, mental issue and then the blood tests don't show anything, but these things come back dysregulated, then you kind of know the person is under chronic stress, or you know, has mental health issues or something. So we'll keep expanding, and not just steroids, but now many other biomarkers that I think even Ray would appreciate. I mean, he's written about epinephrine and norepinephrine and even melatonin, which he doesn't like as a supplement, but it seems like in people with good thyroid function, melatonin levels at night tend to be higher than in euthyroid or hypothyroid people. And one explanation is that the body basically, like, in order to protect you from the rising serotonin with darkness, because it rises in old people, the lack of light causes serotonin to rise. Basically, the body, the organism of healthy people metabolizes a lot of it into melatonin, which is just one step away, and basically puts you to sleep, right, as a way of protecting you while your metabolic rate is naturally lower, or at least your mitochondria is not capable of working as well simply because of the lack of red light.
You know what? We're going to pause for a second. I might have left the stove on.
That's pretty much, we're expanding the testing service to include other metabolites, other analytes, as they call them. That should be of interest, because measuring them in blood, even though it's available, is very hard. If you ask your doctor to measure your epinephrine, norepinephrine, histamine, or serotonin, the test is actually very expensive. You have to ask for whole blood, right? Many of them do serum, which is useless for all these things. And then the sample has to be immediately frozen, deeply frozen, down to negative 20 degrees centigrade, and then shipped to the lab. That makes the test very expensive, and quite unreliable. Even the lab will tell you that they don't guarantee the results because they don't guarantee that the sample would arise was frozen as quickly as possible after harvesting and basically was kept frozen throughout the transportation process. So with this, with the analysis in nail and hair, that issue should be resolved. And then we'll just keep looking through for other things to keep adding to the things that we can analyze. I don't want to be another Theranos, but at the very least, you know, I mean, we'll probably be able to analyze maybe, I don't know, one third of these things that she promised people they will be able to analyze in a drop of blood. We'll probably be able to do about one third of those in nail or hair, about the same size of specimen. Actually slightly bigger, but still. So we'll see. It's pretty interesting. Some interesting results. A lot of doctors that we're discussing with, that we're in touch with, are very interested, starting to send some patients our way. What else? I started the lab in Taiwan has resumed business. And basically now we are starting to do some more in vivo studies. And after the study with vitamin B3 and B1 combination stopping that mantle cell lymphoma, which is a human cancer, but a xenograft model, basically like a transplanted onto mice with suppressed, destroyed immune system. So now I'm going to try to do the same tumor, and we're going to try basically a completely fat-free diet. So we'll see what happens for about a month. I have a feeling we'll get some very interesting results. And if that works, because the fat-free chow is still commercial chow, it's not the best chow. It's got a lot of iron in it. The carbs are mostly from starch, so I don't completely trust the fact that they're not going to add. There's no residual pull forward. They're not going to add it later on, et cetera. So we'll see. But if we get promising results, the follow up to that study will be several groups. One of them will get the fat free chow with some pure saturated fat on top of that. We'll get one which basically is eating powdered, fully defatted milk. So it basically be skim milk on powder and then, again, reconstituted in water. So we'll see how the mice do on that, because it should be able to drop to deplete their iron, of which most animals with cancer have an excess, intracellular iron because of the high ferritin. So that's the in vivo experiment going on. We're also going to try, we're going to do an experiment with vitamin D and K, a combination for several tumor types. There is a study which is currently almost completed at our lab in Bulgaria, basically with hamsters, and it's that fully lethal cancer in hamsters. It's not a human tumor, so the results are not as directly translatable to humans, but basically we tested the serotonin antagonist that we synthesized, like sinanserin and 10-methoxyharmalan, and the Russian serotonin antagonist tropoxin. And it looks like especially the 10-methoxyharmalan did a great job of basically making the animals almost immune to being inoculated with cancer. I did a study with cortinone maybe like 3 years ago, and show that typically the animals that receive no treatment get fully inoculated, successfully inoculated 100% of them by day 8. And then if you treat them with cortinone, this gets extended to like day 16. And then with methoxyharmalan, actually all the serotonin antagonists get effect, but the methoxyharmalan extended the resistance to inoculation up to day 30. And anything over day 20 is basically considered that the animal is immune to the actual inoculation effects. And just because you kept constantly poking it with a needle, eventually actually it succumbs. Its organism starts becoming vulnerable due to pure physical torture. And that's what actually got it vulnerable to accepting these cancerous cells. So the methoxyharmalan essentially made the animal fully immune, and only because the animal essentially was tortured for so long, only then the infection takes hold. But anything 20 days is basically considered a fully prophylactic treatment. So all the serotonin antagonists pass that 20-day mark, with the methoxyharmalan going as high up as 30 days. So we'll see what happens in terms of survival. If the animals survive more than 60 days with any of these treatments, they're considered in remission. In other words, the treatment stopped the cancer. And then after that, we'll see how big the tumor is. There are ethical guidelines that we need to follow. Even if the animals are not dead after 60 days, if the tumor is more than, I think, like an inch in diameter, the study has to end, they're saying, you're torturing the animals. But hopefully we'll have at least one or two that have smaller tumors, and then we'll keep monitoring them and feeding them normally and continuing with the treatment, and then we'll see for how long they survive. If they survive for more than 6 months, it's considered cure.
And what are the chances of the Marburg virus pandemic interfering with your latest test, do you think?
I don't think the Chinese care much about the Marburg virus pandemic. I think they're using the virus, even the current one, for political reasons. In fact, I think they're deliberately shutting down their economy to basically accelerate the collapse of the West. they're using economics for nothing novel. The West has been using economics for military purposes for a very long time. But now the Chinese are doing it because this is their way of avoiding military confrontation, which unfortunately I think one way or another is coming, because the West will actually rather see the world destroyed than quietly rolling over and collapsing, right? And then leaving the world power to the new Eurasian bloc, or at least to the BRICS. But let's not kid ourselves. The leaders of that bloc, the equal partners, are China and Russia.
Did you see that clip? It was probably about a month ago when Biden was like, the next pandemic, like later this fall or something. He said something like right on the nose, like really specific. It was a little bit worrying. And then also, did you see Hunter Biden's, what he had Joe in his phone as? The name?
No.
He had him as, I'm going to like get this podcast banned. He had him as Pedo Peter.
Are you serious?
I'm not joking. That was Biden. I've seen the screenshot. He had his dad as Pedo Peter in his iCloud phone. Isn't that wild?
To me, the wilder part was the diary of his daughter, which basically said that she was showering naked with her dad at the age of 16 and was highly uncomfortable. And a few other things that she thought the diary was like not the best place to express. How much more obvious than that do you want? They want this to get, right? She's writing about her being molested by her own biological father while she's underage, right? I mean, and that person gets elected and tolerated and promoted. I you know what? The Chinese bring the collapse fast. Yeah. It cannot come fast enough. Yeah. I'm so done with this whole charade. It's just unfixable, you know? This is just the moment you try to improve things, and it's like from all directions, all kinds of evil starts streaming and says, no, don't touch it. We like it this way.
Yeah, there's more stuff, but I'll spare people. You can go investigate it yourself. Okay, we should probably wrap up fairly soon. I do coaching on patreon.com/Danny Roddy, and I'm trying to take more people right now. So if you have been waiting, this would be a good time to sign up. And I'm super behind on my email, but I will catch up with everything probably tomorrow. And so I apologize to everyone.
Is there a way you can put in your website like that you're actually looking for people right now? Because there's no easy way for them to know when you're looking for more people or not. Sometimes when they ask me stuff and I redirect them to you to sign up, mm-hmm. they'll reach out and then you have no available spots, right? Is there a way for them to avoid having to ask you constantly, hey, are you free? Are you free? Are you free?
Go into this page is like really the only way I've figured it out. So it's patreon.com/Danny Roddy. But usually I'm not looking for more people to talk to just because it's my business is hard to scale. And then it's really hard to scale when you're learning how to plant trees and other things, because that is taking up all of my time right now. Like I even came in for this because I've been working basically all day outside. And so I just, I have too much to do at the moment. That being said, I'm making an effort to talk to more people and falling behind. So maybe I should cool the effort. let's talk about one or two more articles, and we can save these for next time. Whenever we chat, because you have so many articles.
Let's do one more because it's close to 10:30, and then, pick one that really caught your eye, caught your attention.
Uh, The elephants, thugs, grow up without a father figure. I thought was interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people will probably say, like, the conservatives, like, of course they. All of these bastard children running around, they're up to no good. They cannot be up to any good because they lack a father figure. Well, if you believe that elephant societies are similar to human ones, or at least intellectually or development-wise, we're not that dissimilar, which seems to be the case. They're fairly intelligent. They live in large social groups, but they're matriarchal societies rather than patriarchal, like they said. But the role of the father, even in matriarchal societies, cannot be ignored. It cannot be replaced. So the juveniles that grew without fathers basically became the poster children for what the media used to write about. Basically, the children, the thugs that grew up in broken families, and basically if they model in life, what are they going to do? They're going to find it on the street. Well, in this case, they're going to find it in the bush, or I don't know what inspiration they're getting from where, but at the very least, they're acting like complete thugs, attacking unprovoked, completely unprovoked, other members of their group, as well as other wild animals that are completely innocent. Not that a wild animal can be guilty, but sometimes, like elephants, just like hippos, are very, very territorial, and another wild animal can get in trouble by just, unknowingly encroaching upon the territory of the male. However, these male elephants are basically literally looking for trouble. They're looking for somebody to engage with, for another animal to engage with and harass and potentially even kill. Apparently no good reason. They're expending all of these resources, which is very rare in nature. That's probably one of the reasons why most animals don't hold a grudge. It's just too energetically expensive. We are unique in that respect to the as far as we know, together with elephants and dolphins, by the way, we are known to hold a grudge. And so do crows, the birds of the corvid family. If you harass them or if you somehow wrong them, they'll remember you years later. There's a fascinating article about that. And because they're small and they know they cannot really take upon you by themselves, when they see you years later and recognize you, they're going to bring the entire flock and peck the crap out of you because you wronged them all these years ago. So anyways, long story short, the elephants are basically growing up. The fatherless elephants are growing up to be troublemakers, and they cannot integrate into the proper animal, the proper elephant society, and in the animal structure, overall animal structure in the environment where they live in. They always seem out of place. They always seem to somehow misfit. And this leads to confrontation and eventually fights, which are often lethal, usually for the animal on the other side. But, sometimes when they pick a fight with another thug elephant, often one of them dies. Typically, fights between bull elephants during their rut period, they're not deadly. They're basically fighting for females. They may injure each other, but they're usually not deadly. However, between these elephants, very often they end up being deadly, which is another distinguishing characteristic. Yeah.
Here's an
article. So father's love, a father's love is a father's love and cannot be replaced.
Here's an article that goes along with that. It says, in mammals, prolactin is associated with learning, stimulation of immune response, reduction of body temperature, an increased corticosterone secretion. There's evidence that in families characterized by an absent or alcoholic father, young girls may be predisposed to develop a hyperprolactinemia later in life as a reaction to losses. And so, serotonin stimulates the prolactin that could be involved in maybe the thuggery of the elephants.
Well, I mean, if the SSRIs are now known, you've seen these multiple studies that I've posted, SSRIs basically make serial killers and generally violent and psychotic individuals. There's little doubt that serotonin can cause that. So I think it's just serotonin alone, just by the lack of the father figure and the protection and the nurturing environment that having like two supportive parents provides, that alone, just the chronic elevation of serotonin is enough to turn the animal into a violent thug. To what degree prolactin and other hormones rise, that remains to be determined. But considering that prolactin is a good surrogate for serotonin levels, if you remember that old article from back in 2014, when I first posted it, prolactin is a very good surrogate for intracellular levels of estrogen and serotonin. Conversely, if your serotonin is high, it'll be very hard for prolactin to be low. Why? Because serotonin actually suppresses dopamine, and dopamine and prolactin, even according to mainstream endocrinology, are inversely correlated. Dopamine agonists, or dopamine itself, are used to treat hyperprolactinemia. Conversely, things that inhibit dopamine, like a dopamine antagonist and or a serotonin agonist or serotonin itself, will actually universally raise prolactin.
I'm almost positive this is the paper. We therefore suggest that in man, estrogen and aromatizable androgen influence prolactin secretion, at least in part by involving the activation of the hypothalamic serotonin system.
Yep.
Okay, we'll wrap it up here so I don't hack out a lung on this episode. In closing, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I don't know if you follow in the news. Now everybody's kind of saying, oh, recession is coming. I think it's already here. It's been here since January. The question now is it going to be depression? And more importantly, is Europe going to collapse this fall? I think the U.S. has set things up in a way that the rest of the world, I mean, the world it controls, it's going to collapse before the U.S. does, right, at least economically. But I don't think the system can survive because it's so interconnected. So if somebody like Germany actually has a true economic collapse, which is what they're expecting this winter, this fall, and which is guaranteed to happen unless the war in Ukraine ends like right now, right? Negotiations start, and then August is used to like go through these negotiations and figure everything out piecewise, and then come September, the faucet on the gas thing is turned on again, and then gas starts flowing. Unless this happens, and it's not happening, there's basically zero chance of this happening right now. You're looking at, I mean, the German finance minister already openly warned that entire industries in Germany will collapse. So if Germany collapses, or at least one of the large members of the European Union collapses or has like a severe economic depression, I just don't think how the ripples of this are not going to affect the rest of the Western world. It's just effectively one giant corporation, just as that Reddit thread on Megacorp recently proved. So you just can't have, nothing happens in isolation anymore in the Western financial system. If one country is sufficiently interconnected, what they call it, of systemic importance, they keep talking about banks, but nobody's been talking about countries. And I think now the countries are in trouble. Now, if a country of systemic importance, and Germany certainly is such a country, something bad happens this fall, you're effectively looking at the, probably the open installation of fascism in the Western world, and then CBDCs in early 2023. I don't think Jerome Powell is joking. I think he's basically, why would he lie that the systems are ready and, you know, they'll be ready to go? They keep telling you they're going to be working on this. Which really means, in government spiel, we have it ready to go. We're just looking for the right crisis or a moment to implement it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to the next episode of America and to see what happens next on the television show. So that'll be very, very fun.
How is Ray?
I haven't talked to him since the. I mean, I sent him that email, kind of apologizing for the. He sent me back his gelatin article or something. I haven't talked to him. I mean, kind of leaving him alone. Like, unless some like major piece of information comes out, I think I'll leave him alone maybe for a few months, and then we'll get him back on the show. But I'm just, for the time being, I think I'm enjoying listening to him talk to Patrick Timpone or his other various podcasts he's going on.
That's good. It's good. Even though people seem to not particularly like Patrick. Because he doesn't let Ray talk. He always interjects with his used to promote like monk fruit or something?
No,
every other episode was something about monk fruit.
Are you thinking of Andrew Murray? Because Patrick doesn't.
Oh, Andrew. Andrew Murray.
Patrick's pretty low key. Patrick's funny because he doesn't remember stuff. And so he'll be like, why is the thyroid good, right?
That's awesome.
And Ray will just have to like talk about. Just rehash everything they talked about in the last episode.
It's like the movie Memento. The guy said, you're the best friend I've ever had. Why? Because I get to keep telling the same jokes over and over and you always react like it's the first time you heard
it. That's exactly it. Okay, Georgie, thank you so much. Let's do one last thing. idealabsdc.com and then patreon.com/DannyReddy for me. And so I will edit this. I will release it probably over the weekend or early next week. And Georgie, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Taking your time out to do the show with me. Thank you so much. My partner.
Always a pleasure.
86 episodes. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
And we have an amazing listenership. So thank you guys. Really appreciate all the support we get every single time we do one of these. So really appreciate that. Guys, have a safe weekend. We'll talk to you guys soon. Peace out.